निरञ्जनम् नित्यमनन्तरूपम् भक्तानुकम्पाधृतविग्रहम् वा ईशावतारम् परमेशमीडम् तम् रामकृष्ण शिरसा नमामि. To that pure one who is eternal and yet ever taking new forms, who though himself detached empathizes with each devotee, that Supreme Lord and an embodiment of God, to him, Sri Ramakrishna, I bow my head. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karabhavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Ma Vindvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being, may the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. Seemed to be down in the cellar this morning. Our subject this morning is what Vedanta means to me. If you'll remember, we had some guest speakers couple of months ago during the summer who spoke to us, people who have been in Vedanta for some years, and they spoke to us on what Vedanta meant to them. And I know that most of you who heard them were very much appreciative of that performance. Well, this is my turn now to talk about what Vedanta means to me personally. Why should we talk about what Vedanta means to an individual? Why not just have a title, what Vedanta is, or what Vedanta means? Well, for this very good reason, that this faith is one which asks you to formulate your own religion. From all the vast resources and accounts that are given to us in this realm of scriptures and centuries of experience, we have to pick out what is most meaningful for us. We have the choice, we have the chance. We're not dogmatized, we're not indoctrinated. We have to take out from this mass of material what it is that we want to apply in our own lives and what makes the most meaning for us. That's what Vedanta is. So I have every right to say what this faith and this approach to experience means just to me. And here I'm being un-Vedantic in making myself an individual. I know all that is, that's all Maya and so on, but I'm caught in this Maya just as you are, and I have also got a personality and a history and an experience, and so it is important for... Oh, yes, thank you. That's a good idea for somebody. She can hear this too. I don't think it's on. I'm a Westerner, after all. I was born, brought up, and still am in the West. And for all the fact that I have broadened my religious outlook, I still have an obligation, not just a right, but an obligation to speak as a Western person coming into Vedanta. And I think Vedanta means to me, as a Westerner, something that it may not mean to those who are from another country. So the application of Vedanta to an American scene, an American way of life, an American outlook, is significant. And there's another reason why we have the opportunity to apply this approach to life and thought individually to ourselves, and that is, it was put very succinctly by Swami Vivekananda, our prophet and teacher, founder of our movement, when he said, I think to the consternation of many Hindus, by the Vedas, no books are meant. Vedas, commonly understood, is a set of books, scripture, oral accounts that were eventually written down. Swamiji says, by the Vedas, no books are meant. What is meant is the universal, all-applicable truths, eternal truths, which are good for all time and every country and every place, good for the whole universe, which operate, so far as we know, so far as we can see, throughout all time and space. It's these eternal truths that constitute the Vedas. And those truths can be found in the ancient resources, scriptural and spiritual resources, of every great culture. It happens that India came upon them perhaps first. India has specialized in them. India has embodied them in practice, no doubt. But that doesn't mean that India or the Hindus have a corner on the truths of the Vedas. That's very important to realize. I'm going to divide this talk into two parts. The first part will be content. What Vedanta means to me in terms of content. And second part will be what it means as a way of life. What are the basic truths which the Vedas are? They are the truths which are embodied in the Upanishads. Of all the parts of the Vedas, the most important is the latter part, the concluding portion, which is what Vedanta means, the end of the Vedas, the essence of the Vedas, and those are found in the Upanishads. And those I have been giving to you week after week as we talk about the sages of the Upanishads. We are getting the picture of what those truths are in our various classes and discourses here. So we are preaching to you the basic truths of the Upanishads and their commentary, which is the Bhagavad Gita. We find our manual, our Sermon on the Mount, if you like, our practical application of these abstract Vedic truths, we find embodied in the Bhagavad Gita, where God, taking human form, we believe as Sri Krishna in human form, speaks to man in the first person, speaks to man, gives man his message to mankind, based on the Upanishads, all based on the truths in the Vedas. And then, the other part of the Vedanta literature, or the basic literature, is the Brahma Sutras and other texts. These are technical, aphoristic treatises, which embody the philosophy in a technical and logical form so that it can be picked up by scholars and philosophers, passed on down to students. It's very carefully worked out in such a way that memorization was possible without writing. And those books and Shankaracharya's treatises on Vedanta constitute the rest of the content of Vedanta proper. This is the Shruti, Veda, and the Smriti, which is the all the rest that I described, Gita, Brahma Sutras, Shankara texts. And down to our time, we consider that those scriptures which have been produced by our movement, the teachings of Sri Ramakrishna, the lectures of Swami Vivekananda, Sarada Devi, and so on, these are all part of Vedanta now, as far as we are concerned. But these are our sources, yes. But they're also not our sources. So keep listening. I hope to explain. But when I say that they are our sources, I do not mean by that that these are to be treated as scriptures are in other religions. Oh yes, there are fundamentalists of Hinduism too. There are fundamentalists who accept every word of the Vedas as literally true. I suppose there still are some. There have been for centuries. But if I'm to talk about what Vedanta means to me, I have to say that Vedanta to me does not mean that I have to depend upon the scripture, that I have to hold the scripture as above all other pronouncements that the great realizers of truth have made. I don't put it in front of the pronouncements of Gautama Buddha, for instance. I don't say that they are more true than what Buddha said or more true than what Jesus said. I don't have to say that because these sources which are for me not dogmas, which are not compelling me to accept or to believe. Well, what are these truths? And here come the questions. Are they philosophical truths? Religious truths? Psychological? Theological? Cosmological? I submit to you that I long ago, I've been in now 60 years, and quite early in that span of time, I discovered that these are categories invented by the human mind, by the Western mind, I should say. These are categories devised by Western thinkers, philosophers, and scholars, people who wanted to put thought into straitjackets of their own making. And so, I would have to say, if in the case of each one of these adjectives, yes and no. Are they philosophical? Well, if you say that philosophy means that you spin out a system sitting in your academic chair or your fireside chair and thinking deeply and trying to keep the mind in a rigorous format. They are not philosophical. And yet you know as well as I do, that they are deeply philosophical. They are deeply philosophical because they go into the greatest truth, the biggest questions of our life. What are we doing here? Where did we come from? What is our makeup? Where are we going? All of these are no doubt philosophical questions, but they're not treated in the way that the academic philosophers treat them, the speculators and the spinners of systems. They are transforming truths. That's the most important thing. They are philosophy which transforms you. You cannot adopt a philosophy and sit it on the table and say, now there's my philosophy. Finished, I'll go and turn it into the professor. Or I'll go and publish it and get some kudos. No, you make out this philosophy. It means, I subscribe to this. I intend to try to live by it. I intend to make it my own. This is my philosophy, or this is how I see the truths of the Vedas. I see them in this light. I see them in a monistic light. I see them in a dualistic light. I am going to try to mold myself according to what they demand of my mind. So they are transforming. They are practical. I have seen this, you see, in my 60 years, I have seen how this kind of philosophy transforms lives. I have lived with people who came to it raw, callow, green, any word you want to use to describe how really, you know, rugged and ragged we are when we come to the practice of Vedanta. And I have seen how it has transformed people. I have seen angry people softened. I have seen bitter people made happy. I have seen hard-nosed people softened, sweetened. And I have studied the lives of those who were our teachers and our teachers' teachers and discovered what kinds of changes and transformations philosophy has given to them. So that's what I would say about philosophy. Psychological? Are they psychological truths? Well, if by psychology you mean working in a laboratory somewhere, doing experiments outside your own command, using tools, implements, instruments, making laboratory experiments with which are indirect and which do not demand of you a tremendous amount of involvement personally. If that's what you mean by psychology. Then no, they are not the truths of the Vedas. The Vedanta is not psychological in that sense. It will never be considered so. We don't pretend to tell scientists or psychologists how to design and perform their external experiments. Their experiments upon victims. What do I mean? The experiments upon subjects is the word I want. Experiments upon their subjects, if not their victims. Vedanta takes a different tack psychologically. The psychology of Vedanta, if Vedanta is psychological, is the psychology of self-analysis. If you want to investigate sleep, yes, you can get a whole laboratory full of people, put them to sleep and wire them up and take their EEGs or whatever they are. And then you make some experiments and you wake them up and you ask them questions and you see the REM and all. Grand, that's fine. That's not Vedanta. I mean, it may be, may have a bearing on Vedanta. But our approach to psychology is to understand what sleep means to us. I have to investigate my own sleep. I have to understand why I go to sleep. What happens when I go to sleep? Do we all sleep in the same way? Or are there differences? And if so, what are they? And I have to approach it from the standpoint of my own consciousness. I make the a priori assumption that I, as a consciousness, am the witness, the observing screen against which all of the phenomena of life play. And I identify myself with that by stages, withdrawing myself from identity with the mind, the memory, the ego, the intellect, and so on, the emotions. And I bypass these things to come to the consciousness with which everything is registered in the long run, in the end. I study perception. I study the phenomena of hypnosis. What's going on in hypnosis? Is it part of the waking state? Is it part of the dream state? Is it part of a separate state by itself? These kinds of things belong to the realm of Vedanta. And you can say that's a subjective approach to psychology. Yes. Yes. A psychology which pontificates about the nature of man, the mind, and the psychophysical organism without discovering how it operates within oneself is no psychology at all, according to us. All right, let's come to theology. Theological, again, if it's external, if it consists of getting degrees in a seminary, I'm sorry. I apologize to our visitors when they come from a seminary. If it consists in getting these degrees from seminary and getting preacher's gown and cap and becoming an authority on God by means of books and church doctrines, or through what do they call those Muslim schools?
Madrasas.
Yes, madrasas and such things. So all of those things, you know, can produce theologians. And I have heard a number of theologians in my day. One of the ones that I heard last was a great theologian who came to New York. We were all brought out to hear him, and we enjoyed his lecture, and there were hints in it that perhaps theologians have not yet discovered everything to be found out about God. But when the assumption is made that through theology, through the traditional organizations and teachings that make theologians, we can get a true picture of the universe and the Creator and our relation to it and ourselves, we demur. We beg to differ with you. Here I have to bring in the example of the film, which I saw last week. What the bleep do we know? That film is a Vedantic film in everything but name. I hope every one of you can see it. It's never be another one like it. I'm sure there'll never be another one like it. And I think it's practically dirty gear. I mean, you have to say it's compulsory for our congregation to go and see the picture called What the Bleep Do We Know? Because it shows us how little is known by people who talk about God and people who think that they have understood God from the religion, from the standpoint of religion. The Vedantic approach to what you call, what people call in the West, God. You know, it's an English word, and the minute that you use it, in 99 and 99 hundredths% of the Western minds, when they hear that word, have a picture of a personal being. We don't necessarily have that. Yes, we can include the picture of a personal being, but that does not exhaust our picture of the deity. Our picture of the deity is much more like what we saw in that film than it is the traditional Western picture of the deity. Theology, yes, it is theology. If theology is comprehensive, if it includes the fields of life, if we understand the divine being as being something discoverable in every avenue of life, from every angle, from every approach that one can want to make, if you can understand the deity in those terms, then I would say, yes, it's theology, because our approach to God or approach to theology is comprehensive, experiential. It's not theological in the Judeo-Christian sense. I think I can safely say that in almost no Judeo-Christian sense of the concept of deity is our theology of that type. Because it goes beyond God. I have to remind you that the Vedas, in their very own terminology, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the Vedas say, in that highest experience of man, in that great born beyond the limits of our mental conception or our mental field, there the pundit becomes no pundit, the monk no monk, the father no father, the teacher no teacher, the Vedas no Vedas. There, in that experience, the Vedas are left behind. So is the personal God. So, you see, it's a very different framework of theology than what we are accustomed to. Even, I point out to those of you who are, like me, from a Christian background, Meister Eckhart has said the same thing. And for that, the Church condemned him. Utterly condemned him, and became anathema. Fortunately, he died already. So, in that sense, we can say the theology of Vedanta is quite different from what we know of theology. Cosmological? Is it cosmology? If by cosmology you insist that the experience must be experimental, that the doctrine and the experiment and the truths that are subscribed to must be provable by more than one person, and by more than one person, and in the way in which you prescribe that it must be understood, perceived. If you insist that cosmology is something which you can put into books and say this concludes our discovery of the universe, or if you insist that cosmology must follow the pronouncements of certain kinds of individuals who are trained in a certain way with certain degrees in a scientific framework, then I would say no, and yet, you see, they are cosmological because they were formulated, they were put into language, which in their day was cosmology. It was the world and the universe and themselves as they understood it in that day. So in that sense, it was experiential. It was cosmological in the sense that it left the door open for all future experiments and discoveries. It never closed the door. Swami Vivekananda is quite firm about saying that the canon of the Vedanta is never closed. The canon of God's truth is never closed. There's no closed canon. Nobody can say the last revelation. See, that's the trouble. We have Baha'i emblem here on the wall. But Baha'i, with all of its broadness, with all of its inclusiveness, and all of its welcoming of all faiths, says that their prophet is the last prophet. They're not going to be anymore. We don't say that. We've never said that. We've always said that God's book remains open. He will send prophets from now until doomsday. He will be sending more and more prophets. And there's no one who can claim to be the last prophet. So that sort of changes the picture with respect to other religions. There are contact points with scientific cosmology of today, and that was easily demonstrated in the film, that many of the talking heads, as we call them, of that film reminded us of what Buddha had said and of what the Tao says, and Jesus was even mentioned, and I was quite surprised that there was as much religion in it as there was. But the points of contact between what we call Vedanta and the basic attitude of investigation in science is a major point of contact. Investigation, right, that is the spirit of both modern science and Vedanta. Investigate, find out for yourself, experiment and investigate. And it's through the investigation of our own being, our own nature, our own senses, our own perceiving capacities that we discover the truths that are embodied in Vedanta. We did it by investigation. We have done it by investigation. The principal question, I would say, if of all the questions being asked in the Upanishads, the most important one is that one in the Chandogya, which we started with our sages with. The pupil, the disciple, asks, "Sir, what is that knowing which we can know everything?" He studied all of the sciences, all of the known subjects of education at that time. He studied poetry and prosody and all of these things that the Vedic students studied, including the philosophy. And then he asks the teacher, "What is that, knowing which we shall know everything? What is the key? What is the Rosetta Stone? What is the clue? What opens the door to all knowledge?" And then, you see, that opens the whole book. From there on, the book goes on and on and on. The truths are unrolled, which bring the pupil back to that one entity, Tat, which is the clue and the source and the essence of all knowledge. And Tat Tvam Asi, that thou art. The unity of the knower, the known, and knowledge. The trinity of known, knowledge, known, knower, known, and the relation between them, which is called knowledge, become one. And that's the conclusion of the Vedanta. Well, all of these, you see, psychological, cosmological, philosophy, theology, and philosophy, all of these are interrelated. You cannot examine, we say investigate, okay. Those who investigated the universe first, the scientists of the earlier centuries of our Renaissance, did not discover clearly that in order to investigate the universe, we have to investigate our personal mind-body complex. The fault, if there is a fault, of the Vedic investigators was that they didn't yet have the tools and the incentives and the initiative and cleverness to investigate all of the external aspects of the universe. That was left for the West to do. What the West was clever with, India was not, and vice versa. Now we've come full course, we've come full circle, and we have to say, to investigate the universe means I have to investigate myself. I cannot examine myself without seeing what the implications are for the whole world, the universe. I cannot examine the universe without seeing what the implications are for me. The other day I went to a conference on the law and religion, and it was very interesting. It was at the law school, Emory Law School. I was invited and taken there, and I was just an observer, but we broke down into sections, you know. It's one of those meetings where you have a big gathering and you hear a couple or three speakers and then you break down into discussion sessions. Those are all very interesting things. So I don't know whether they ever prove anything or get anywhere, but anyway, we did. And in that breakdown session, it became, we had one of the speakers in our section. And it became quite clear to me, I commented on it, and I don't know how it was received, I commented on it, that the West, so far as the law is concerned, laws are laws everywhere. India as a country has to have national laws. It has to have law throughout. But law as a philosophy, law as a part of one's outlook on life, takes on a different cast. It was clear to me that the Western approach to law is how best to regulate masses of people so that their interrelationships become smooth, and how to keep the land and the society, the environment and the world in general from being despoiled and so on. The whole thrust of Western law is made on the assumption that we as perceivers don't have any problem. we can, if we are bright enough, intelligent enough, we can look at the situation outside and make our judgments and decisions about what we see there, and our decisions will be correct. Well, whereas in the Orient, and I'll say I think this applies throughout the Orient, if not, at least it applies, I'm sure it applies in vast, almost entirely throughout the Orient. The assumption is made. Go to the Tao Te Ching. Read there. See. What is government? Government starts with governing oneself. The whole idea of government, the whole idea of law, starts with me. If I am not lawful, truthful, correct, dharmic, let's use that word, dharmic. If I am not dharmic, if things aren't right here, how in the world will I be able to be a judge? How in the world can I be a prosecutor? How can I pitch my pitch? If I do not have this integrity within myself, will I be able to make judgments about the integrity of other policies and to rule? See, that's the Eastern approach to the law and religion, and I found it to be quite striking contrast there. What I find is appreciated in the West about the truths of the Vedanta is that they are both old and new. They are ancient and therefore dignified, respected, and so on. upheld by generations of followers. And they are new in the sense that they are open to discovery. The spirit of discovery is never left behind. If tomorrow it's proved that the Vedas were all concocted, the written Vedas were all concocted by a certain group of scribes in a certain century, I don't think it's going to make any difference to the Vedanta. And you know, they satisfy the intellect and they satisfy the heart. And that is what makes a philosophy acceptable. That is what makes a doctrine or a view of life precious to us, that we are satisfied in our intellect and satisfied in our emotions as we hear and appreciate and try to understand and embody these truths. These are the things that you are getting here all the time. I have finished my first part. I have finished the discussion of the content of Vedanta. And this content is what is being taught here in the center two or three times a week. Yes, three times a week and over the years. So I think that's what Vedanta means to me in terms of content. Now a much more important, I think, subject. What it means to me as a way of life. I read in boyhood the lives of distinguished persons. I was very fond of biography. And I read many biographies of famous people. I still remember some of those that attracted and molded my life. Theodore Roosevelt, Mozart, Christopher Columbus, Lewis and Clark. These are some of the ones that I remember best. Louisa May Alcott. And as a result of my boyhood reading, I became very fond of the study of a human life, what a human life means, just even in one incarnation, childhood to old age. And I have come to the conclusion, you know, there's a big, there, you can read it in any of the great books of quotations, almost side by side. Heroes are born, not made. Or, heroes are made, not born. You've heard both things. Yeah. Swami Vivekananda, in one place, says, heroes are born, not made. And somewhere else in his works, you can find the opposite idea. That don't go by what's born. Go by what you can do with it. My conclusion is, heroes are both born and made. Some heroes are born heroes, and some people make themselves heroes. I don't think you can put it into either one. I give you a phrase which is what Vedanta means to me in terms of way of life. Yeah. Okay. And those two words are total commitment. Total commitment is my definition of Vedanta. What did Jesus say? Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy mind and all thy strength. That's what I mean by total commitment. I think there are three essentials for finding what you want, for achieving what you desire in life, requires three essential traits. The desire for it must be strong. the determination to bring it about must be fixed, permanent. And the faith that it can be done, and by you, has to be strong. So desire, determination, and faith are the three ingredients for success that I would prescribe for a person who, following the way of life of Vedanta, aspires to reach its goal. Swami Vivekananda one time invited to dinner, and in New York, some society lady, she put on a party and invited him to dinner. And knowing Swamiji to be a religious person of religion, they all sat down at the table, and she said, "Swami, would you please say the grace?" And he said, "Madam, I say grace to you. You have done all the work." Now that is what I'm talking about here. He didn't want to say grace to God. He wanted to say grace to the person who had given totally of herself to make this party come about. Doesn't mean that he didn't believe in God, but he meant that that's the way he wanted to thank on that occasion. If you want an example of what it means to use desire, determination, and faith fruitfully, I cannot give you a better one than that of Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan. A woman born with the most handicapped kind of body you can imagine, almost, pulling herself up with these ingredients and with the help of someone who rose to the same occasion, feeling herself totally inadequate to it, Annie Sullivan made herself fit for it and accomplished it, teaching of Helen Keller. So, total commitment gives rise to self-realization in the long run. And that self-realization takes different forms. I'm not talking just about samadhi or nirvana or spiritual accomplishment. I'm talking about the realization of the capacity of the individual to operate at full force, at full value. Then could I say that Vedanta supports total commitment in any form? Total commitment to anything? In a way, yes. I think it does. I think it does mean that. You don't want to say total commitment to evil? No. And yet, in Vedanta, we discover, eventually, that there is nothing secular. Nothing is really secular. The cook who succeeds in turning out an expert meal, which is appreciated by all of the consumers. The cobbler who makes the very best possible shoe that can be made out of leather. Any workman, any craftsman, any artist, any scholar, any performer in any field who succeeds through total commitment in perfecting that skill or that art or that field is, I think, an example of a Vedantist. That's how I personally feel about it. Nothing is really secular. We make that distinction of secular and spiritual, but the scientist in the laboratory who is absolutely dedicated to the truth and the purity and the integrity of his experiment or her experiment, and understands its limitations and takes into account all of the factors which are involved in propounding that as a truthful discovery. All of that is Vedanta. Sri Ramakrishna used to put it in this way, in a nice little formula in Bengali, Manush. Manush is man, a human being in Bengali. Manush and Manhush. Manhush in Bengali means an enlightened mind. Man is the embodiment of enlightenment. A true man is one whose mind is enlightened. That's what it means. Manush must be Manhush. The man must be a person with an enlightened mind. What did Jesus say? He said, because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I spew thee, I spit you out. I spit you out of my mouth like something that you've taken. Coffee, you want coffee hot. Who wants lukewarm coffee? Lemonade, perhaps you want it cold. Or iced tea, you want it cold. You don't want it lukewarm. So similarly, when something is passed off as what it's supposed to be, and it's lukewarm, it's rejected by those who know. So total commitment means to be sure that we are committed to something. Just as in existentialism, one of the great attractions of the period of existentialism was that the existentialist philosophy told you, you must make yourself something. You have to make something of yourself. You have to become. You have to make your birth on earth worthwhile and not just something in the flock. And the whole idea of being authentic, that's what it means to me. Vedanta means be authentic. Total commitment to something should make you authentic. Of course, not to evil. We're talking about the aspiration for higher pursuits. Well, now, you may come back at me now and say, well, that's fine. That's okay for a monk. You can say this because you're a monk, and you can say that you've given your whole life to it, and you can be totally committed. And how can we do that? A monk or a nun can do that, but how about us? Well, I'll have to point out to you certain lives in the history of the Vedanta movement and in other places where the subject of that life, the person living that life, was by total commitment molded into something which rose far above the place, a situation in which he occupied or she occupied. I give you these examples. The Holy Mother, we call her Sharada Devi, who was a housewife, housekeeper, not a member of an order, who lived in the world with her relatives, constantly facing and irritated by crankiness, and who completely committed herself to spiritual path and rose above all those handicaps and importunities. Nag Mahashray was a saint of Sri Ramakrishna, disciple. The master Mahashray, who recorded the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. These people were not monks or nuns. Their lives were exemplary. Their lives were extraordinary. People came to them at the end of their lives to be their disciples, to take initiation from them. Look at Mahatma Gandhi. There is a life which is not bound by any monastic code, member of no organization or religion or bond of any kind like that. Didn't put himself in a framework that would help him to do this. And yet, look what he became on his own by total commitment to truth. My Life, My Experiments with Truth, is the name of his book. So, every religion makes a pitch for total commitment to you. So, why be a Vedantist instead of a Muslim or a Taoist or something else? Well, that's true. But I find, personally, that only Vedanta shows why and how we are to move towards the highest truth, which it spells out for us a goal and a comprehensive aspiration, which we can follow by, which can achieve by following a step by step the ladders and paths that other great souls have trod before us. I went looking when I came to Vedanta. I went looking for lives. I went looking for a life which would embody all the things that I had tried to be and wasn't able to be. And I found them. I found them in Vedanta. In this Ramakrishna movement, I found them. I've written up only 6 of them in my book. I found many more than that. I found a dozen, probably, of people whose lives and whose demeanor, whose approach were so spectacularly special that I am hard put to describe them, and I wouldn't even try. I have seen the reward of total commitment. You know, it's by definition, it seeks no return or reward, because that's what total commitment means. I give myself without aspiration or expectation of any return or reward. I just want to give, and I give. And that's why I give. But the reward is a quality of life, the like of which I have not seen very often in any other place. Oh, I have seen some Quakers, yes. I have seen a Buddhist nun. I have seen other non-Vedantists who achieved this quality of life. But not a whole lot. And I have seen a lot in this particular, along this particular path. So, discovery. And this is the discovery that comes with total commitment, that the universe is the far end of a telescope of which the lens is my own heart. I have received your comments or questions. Yeah, hi?
Swami, what's the difference between desire and determination for truth and the type of desire that we try to minimize in our lives? Not in what you're desiring, but the nature of
A little louder and say it again.
What's the difference between the nature of the desire for truth and the desire that we try to minimize for other things in life? Not
Our new desire, most of the things we desire in life, you're playing with grains of sand. You're playing with marbles. I mean, we're kids playing with bright little shiny marbles. Dolls and toys. Most of the desires that we have are for dolls and toys, okay? To put it bluntly. Sorry. But when we desire God, when we desire the highest, it makes those things so petty, so trivial. It's very hard to sustain those desires when your whole being is desiring enlightenment. See? That's the thing, yes. Other questions?
When you spoke about faith in the same context, mm-hmm. desire, determination, and faith, can you talk a little bit about what
kind of faith
means to you?
This faith, see, there isn't, that's the English word. But the Sanskrit word is Shraddha. Mm-hmm. And Shraddha has a lot of implications that you can't put into English. It's affirmative, avoiding all negativities. It's a positive, a conviction of the positive content of your own being. I can, I have this power, I have this capacity to do this, and I know that deep within me somewhere I can do it. I can't fail. That kind of shraddha, that's what Nachiketa had in the Katapanishad. And that's what we mean by faith there. Faith that I don't have to make sure that all the horoscopes are telling me rightly, that the stars are in the right places and I've read my astrology correctly. See, that's not what I mean by shraddha, faith. People who depend on those things are lacking in Shraddha, which is self-conviction that here is divinity. God is living in here and God will manifest in here if I find him rightly. See? That is the thing. That's Shraddha. Question?
When you say what Vedanta needs to be, do you need to say what Advaita Vedanta means to you?
Well, yes and no. Vedanta means to me ultimately Advaita. Yes. I think the final conclusion of Vedanta is non-dualism, Advaita. But that doesn't mean that I don't consider the steps that are necessary for the realization of that experience to be true. I do. I accept all the steps in between, too. Bhakti yoga, Raja yoga, Karma yoga, Jnana yoga.
But would you then say that Visishtadvaita and Dvaita Vedanta are not ultimate truths?
What?
Visishtadvaita and Dvaita. Now, the qualified monism and dualism, which Ramanuja and Madhva expounded upon, would you say that they are lower?
Well, now then we have to go into an analysis of what we mean by the absolute truth. We have to define what we mean by the absolute truth. I think probably I should leave off the word truth and just say I think Advaita is the absolute. Now you can't ask me your question.
So isn't that an extreme position?
What?
Isn't that an extreme position?
Yes, I'm a cop out. Yeah, I copped out. Yeah. Okay. Frankly admit I copped out.
My question would mean that in Vedanta there are no extremes.
There are no what?
You cannot make an extreme absolutist statement.
No.
In Vedanta, is that
no, that's right. That's right. No, ultimately, you are correct. I bow to you.
See, in the example, you are giving example that total commitment is not just something which is positive for monks or nuns, but householder could do it. and you give three examples, Holy Mother, Nag Mahashaya, and Master Mahashaya.
Yes.
These are examples where they came in direct contact and touch with Sri Ramakrishna, and it was different atmosphere and different influence altogether.
Yes.
Have you seen any examples in modern time?
Yes.
Ramakrishna's time was modern time too, but in 21st century, with a regular householder like what we are, without being in Dakshineshwari, it became possible for householders.
Gandhiji didn't meet Sri Ramakrishna. Now I come back at you. I mentioned Gandhi, and he didn't. Ramana Maharshi didn't come in contact with Sri Ramakrishna. But of course, he might say he's a monk. But he didn't enter any order. He didn't belong to any particular order. Householders like yourselves, okay, granted, start with handicaps. Granted, you start with handicaps. But, you see, there have been, in every great religion, there have been people. In Islam, the Sufis don't have monastic orders, and yet there are Sufis who have had total enlightenment. So how would you explain that? Rumi was a householder. Jalaluddin Rumi, the greatest of the Sufis, poets, mystics. He wasn't, he had a wife and children, and he became Rumi. How do you explain it? It can be done. It can be done.
Well, Swami, I can answer his question. I personally have seen several people in India, in my stay in India for 27 years, when I was born and brought up. I've seen householders becoming enlightenment right in front of me. And one of the examples was of my father's guru. He has four daughters. He was a primary school teacher. And he's a completely enlightened being. I mean, I have seen him. And I think coming back to the question you mentioned, that all these three people are in direct contact with Sri Ramakrishna. I think the more our faith increases, he will feel the presence of Sri Ramakrishna in our lives and with you. I think that's what I think removes the absence of Sri Ramakrishna or some higher being in our life.
Yes, Julian?
Yes, I'd like to comment on that question too. We did see the movie on Friday night, What the Bleep Are We Doing?
Yes.
What strikes me with this question is the chiropractor, genetic PhD, who talked about at the beginning of every day creating his day, of taking time to create his day.
Right.
So if we're looking at the steps towards enlightenment, understanding that as householders and individuals we can't sort of one day wake up enlightened, if at the beginning of every day I see it as, okay, if there's karma yoga or bhakti yoga, those steps, you can totally commit to that step. And, you know, maybe at the end of the day, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But the concept of making that commitment on a daily or an hourly or a minute-by-minute basis is how I understand that commitment.
Now you saw the film. You both saw the film.
Yeah.
Do you agree with my recommendations of it?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Did you see it already? What do you say?
I thought it was a mixed bag of things. Some very good points and some other points I would have liked more explanations and discussions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the scientist among us said the same thing. I'm the literary one, and I thought it was fabulous. The scientist wanted more explanation.
What is the movie that you're talking about?
What the Bleep Do We Know?
What the Bleep Do We Know?
That's the name of it, yeah. They've taken out the word hell and put in bleep. What the Bleep Do We Know?
Where did you see the movie?
It's over at Garden City. It's in down Midtown.
Midtown.
Yeah, it's...
Swami, I have a question.
Yeah, we got to hurry up here. Yeah.
Well, I'm reading the lives of Sufi saints.
Who?
Sufi women saints. And it's really amazing. And what I understand is that the Sufis are the Muslims. They believe in formless Brahman, you can say, which is God. And I don't know whether I'm asking you, it's a correct question or not, but what is the difference between, or is there any difference between the formless aspect of the Sufis and the Vedantins, which you said is without book?
Well, I see, I can only go by what the Sufis tell me. I haven't had the experience or realization of the formless God through the Sufi path. But I'm assuming that since Sri Ramakrishna was able to do it, that all paths do lead to the same experience ultimately. So I'm assuming, not from my experience, but from example of Ramakrishna, that there wouldn't be any difference between, formless God is formless God. Difference means form. And if formless God would be different. They describe it as light. Now light doesn't have to have form. If there are no more questions, I want to make some announcements. Somebody is the circus. The circus. The Moscow circus is coming to town in November, early November, and they have sent us some tickets, children's tickets, and one adult ticket. I'm going to leave them in that place where it says help yourself by the door. And if you want to take tickets for your kids, there they are. Quite a few free tickets. But there's only one adult ticket, and I'm not going. So I'll leave it. And the other thing that I want to say by way of announcement is, we have tried here to make this an informal atmosphere. And that was what was wanted by the group when we first moved in here. This arrangement for seating, for instance, was your decision, not mine. And we tried to not like a church, if possible. I know that many of you appreciate that we're not so much like a church. And yet, there's one custom of the church in the churches that I think I have got to adopt. It seems to be a wise thing to do, and so I'm going to ask you to adopt this. I'm going to be the first to leave the room, and I'm going to stand out there and greet each of you, because it often happens that I have something to say to, and somebody has already gone. And I also want to greet you. I want to greet the Lord in you. And if you don't mind waiting just enough to file out the way they do to the preacher in the church, I think this will be a very good thing for me. It'll help me much. And thank you. So let's say our prayer.
Visitors.
Visitors. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we have three visitors this morning. Would you introduce yourself?
This is Jeanette Meyer. We visited here a few months.
They came with Barbara. With Dr. Taylor. Dr. Taylor, yes. Dr. Taylor's class, yes. Melanie and Jeanette. And you? Yeah.
Steve Hamby.
Yeah, you've been here before.
No, first time.
First time? Steve what?
Hamby.
Hey, thank you. How did you find us?
Somebody around on the internet.
Well, there you see. Pays to ramble around on the internet. All right, let's say our benediction. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the heaven, in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees. And may the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
And let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Om, peace be unto us, all beings everywhere.